listening, or you're about to listen to After Party Pod, which is the podcast that's a part of AfterPartyChat.com, a website that's all about addiction and recovery. I am Anna David. Did I say that already? I am your host. I am going to be talking today to arguably the most delightful man I know. I'm just trying to think. I know a lot of delightful men. He's really, he's top five. It's really high up. His name is Sam Lansky, and he is this wunderkind, I would say, if I spoke German. Or maybe I'd say wunderkind. I don't really know. But I do know that he's a writer of such immense talent that if you've ever read anything by him, you know what I mean. I've worked with him many times, and I'm constantly sort of amazed at not only how articulate he is, but at how he's funny, he's original, I'm obsessed a little bit. He's gay. Should I mention that he's gay? I used to have a thing where I would get obsessed with gay guys, like really, really obsessed and think I could convert them and stuff like that, but that's something I've stopped doing. So this is, this is the only gay guy I'm obsessed with. And it's been ever since I've met him. So it's not like this is an ephemeral thing. It's been a couple years. And so he lives in New York, but he was in LA. And so I leapt at the opportunity to interview him for this podcast because I knew he would be very fun to talk to. And I was right. I was right. So, enjoy Sam Lansky. Enjoy this podcast. If you enjoy it, I just ask that you write a nice little thing on iTunes about it and then tell a friend or 19 friends. And that's it. I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for downloading. Bye. Oh my God, Sam Lansky.
Hey.
So we're a little bit like Madonna because we were just having a conversation and then we realized there was no point in having a conversation if it wasn't being recorded.
That's like the only reason. I mean, for posterity, like you have to record it.
But also, does it happen if it's not being recorded to and listened to by other people?
No. Literally no.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Okay, so I'm sort of obsessed with you, which is I do think how we should start this.
I love that.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with me, too.
I know.
I'm also obsessed with
but
you.
But you're not. And that's part of my obsession with you, is that, like, you're intrigued. I think you might be intrigued by me, but obsessed not. And that kind of keeps this going. So let's talk about the various stages of obsession and how I came to this place where we find ourselves.
I love that. Let's trace back the history.
This might be the best
minute
of your life. Yeah. Okay, so what happened is, I want to say 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Yeah, two summers ago, I think.
I was working at this website it was like a very crazy, crazy place where not a lot of good stuff happened. And we got pitched completely insane things only by lunatics.
Right.
So one day...
Which I didn't realize, by the way, when I pitched, a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, sent me this website and was like, you should write for this, you would be perfect for this. And I was, I was just about to graduate from college. From undergrad.
Yeah.
And I had published basically nothing.
Nothing. I discovered you, is what you're saying.
You discovered me. You discovered me and made me into the icon
that Korean pop icon,
exactly.
And the Anna
Everything.
David icon.
All of it.
I know.
It. Especially the Anna David.
That's
icon.
A big deal.
Yeah. So I hadn't published anything. I'd done some, like, I'd interned for like a celebrity gossip outlet and like had clips from there, but that was the extent of my writing output.
So what happens to me is I had this crazy person that I worked for, and he never did anything, but he got that email. For whatever reason, that went to him first, and nothing ever impressed him, certainly nothing I ever did. And he sent it to me, and he said, we just got this brilliant piece. And it was the most brilliant, honestly, the most brilliant piece of writing I had ever read about addiction and Britney Spears.
And so kind of you.
But the only one, I can say for life.
The only one.
No, but I mean, like, it was so, and so he and I just were like, who is this person? did not occur to either of us that you were male, because Sam can go either way.
Sure.
And it just felt very female. I honestly really? Don't think I thought a man could be that smart. Like, I...
Oh, stop.
I don't know what it was.
That's a
I was
tremendous compliment. 100%
convinced you were female.
Tremendous.
And compliment. I didn't know where you had come from or what this was. And it was also, by the way, like a novella. Can we talk about how long it was?
It was very, very lengthy.
It was, I want to say, 5,000 words.
It was about that, yeah. It was really, really a very long piece.
And so I guess what happened then, this part I'm vague on, I must have emailed you.
You emailed me, and then I remember we spoke on the phone.
Yes, and yeah. I must have realized at that point you were male.
You must have.
Yes.
Although I didn't realize that was what was happening
no,
for you.
No. How could you?
Right. I was just excited to be like, you know, talking to an editor about like a piece of my writing.
Right, yeah. right. And so then we had to chop it because it was so lengthy, and we ran it, and because of some of the craziness of that site, some things would run, and then you began writing for me regularly, which was a great joy and privilege.
Oh, stop.
But one of our many issues was that there was an editor who wasn't particularly well, so that person would go in and change things and make them illiterate or just riddled with crazy errors.
Introduce typos
to the equation.
Yeah.
And then I would get in trouble if I ever tried to fix that. Or acknowledge this. It was like a
I didn't
whole...
know that was happening on your end, but that's...
Oh, the whole thing was just madness.
Yeah, it sounds like a fucking nightmare.
But the nice thing about you, and so I had various levels of honesty with the different writers I was working with, because you can't really tell everybody that that's what's going on. And so, but I do remember that, like, I was just sort of straight with you. I was like, look, this is the situation. I'm so sorry.
I remember that.
Just tell me when you see, like, a crazy sentence inserted into your brilliant writing. Right. Okay. So then... I feel that I was like sort of a front row witness at the evolution of the career of Sam Lansky, because as we were saying before, I'm impossible to impress, and I was super impressed with you.
I'm so flattered.
And then you started writing, and then you did this interesting thing where you went to Oregon.
Yeah, I went out to Oregon and then down to San Francisco
for a long time,
for about a year. Yeah.
And what was that about?
I had been working in, like, celebrity gossip, basically, in New York full-time after graduating, and it was just kind of running me into the ground, and I didn't want to do it anymore, and I wanted to work on longer projects. I had a book that I wanted to work on. I wanted to do some freelance stuff, and I sort of had an inkling that that I was capable of doing more or better work and writing for more kind of elite outlets than... What I had been starting to do, and I wanted to have the latitude to do that, and build up some clips.
But it wasn't like a personal sanity thing, too.
It was also a personal thing. New York was getting me down. New York was kind of trying to. New York was beginning to corrode my spirit, and I was exhausted.
And you went to college. You went to Vassar. I know you went to a number. Take us through your educational experience and various trips to rehab.
Sure. That's a long conversation.
we're going to condense it as much as you want to condense it.
So when I graduated from high school, let's start there.
Okay. Which was in?
2006.
And what city?
In New York City.
Okay.
Yeah. From a private school in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately after graduating from high school, I was sent to Wilderness Rehab, and then placed in an inpatient rehab for chemical dependence, and then eventually placed in, like, a psych ward, and then, like, sort of broke out of there and said, okay, I'm going to go to Vassar, which I had been admitted to when I had applied as a senior.
Okay, but these admissions to these various institutions were because of you... It's not that this was a random thing.
Oh, no.
This is where you needed to go.
I was a wild child. I was totally out of control.
And you were like... So what were you doing? How did this all start?
I think the main problem for me was really prescription drugs. Like, it was Adderall, and it was...
And when were you prescribed that? How old were you?
I was old when I was prescribed that. I didn't have my own prescriptions for it until I was, like, 15, 16.
I love that that's old.
I mean, it's old, I think, in the context of, like, all of the people who are prescribed drugs like Adderall and Ritalin from a really young age.
Right, right.
I started with Ritalin and then moved on to Adderall. I'd taken it recreationally and, like, had gotten it from friends and knew that I really liked the way it made me feel.
Right.
And so I just kind of went out and got my own prescriptions, and then that led to, you know, because I was taking and also snorting so much Adderall,
right.
I couldn't sleep incredibly.
Right.
And so I was prescribing Ambien for sleeping, and then I was abusing that and taking it with the Adderall. And
What's that combo like?
Really weird.
Fuck,
really
I
weird.
Bet.
Yeah. But sort of like a dream for me, because it was like Ambien produces retrograde amnesia. Like, you hear all of these like weird stories about people like taking Ambien and then waking up
in their eating.
Yeah, and like binge eating.
Right.
Yeah. There's a great little thing from the New Yorker a couple years ago called the Ambien Cookbook. That's like, you know, all of the shit that people put in their bodies when they're on Ambien, which is like, you know, you wake up like chewing on an electrical cord and think like, oh, these red vines are so delicious.
Okay, here's the thing. I took Ambien. I actively abused Ambien for, same, I would say, 7 or 8 years. Never did I find myself eating.
Really?
Yes.
It must be like a very specific personal idiosyncratic thing.
Yet enough for it to be a big media story.
I guess that's true. Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, it's probably something that like affects certain people some ways and other,
yeah,
people.
Yeah. I feel a little disappointed in my brain chemistry.
I understand that.
But I will tell you what Ambien did do to me, because I also would like to point out that I was abusing Ambien way before the press. Nobody knew about Ambien. Yeah. This was like my little
discovery.
And I didn't do it for quote unquote fun.
Really?
Because I'm a lifelong insomniac.
Yeah.
And so I was prescribed that, and I saw it as totally separate from my drug problem.
Yeah.
Even though what I would do with those prescriptions, I was told to cut the pills into fourths.
Yeah.
And I would take 10 of those that I was supposed to be cutting into fourths, so I guess 40 times.
Right.
Is that, I can't do math, but that is that 40 times?
That's 40 times.
What I was supposed to be taking, because the thing about Ambien, the worst thing about it, and there are bad things, is that you build up a tolerance real fast.
You do, you build up a tolerance. I would because it produces retrograde amnesia, I would forget that I had taken my Ambien. So I would take Ambien an hour later. I would say, shit, I need to take my Ambien. And then I would, an hour after that, because I was on so much Adderall, it wouldn't actually put me to sleep. So I'd just be in this, like, weird waking dream space.
Right.
So then I'd be like, fuck, I have to take my Ambien.
That sounds awful.
And so I just end up, like, taking, like, 12 Ambien over the course of a night.
And until not sleeping.
And not sleeping until going deeper and deeper into this, like, waking dream, Ambien coma.
Absolutely horrible.
It was fucking awesome. I loved
it. Okay, interesting.
I loved it.
Well, because my Ambien thing was that I would take it, and then when I was taking 10 of those a night, I would find myself, I never took it during the day, I never took it for quote-unquote fun, but I would find myself driving and be like, where am I going?
Yes.
Why? Right. Why am I going somewhere? And I'd go, I don't know, I'm going to go home now.
Yeah, that happens to people frequently, I think. And there have been so many stories about, like, accidents where people just, like, wake up and they're, like, fucking on the road, like, high on Ambien and have no memory of getting into their car.
But I never thought of myself as high the next day. I assumed once I woke up, because, again, there was nothing out there about this drug then.
Right.
But so... Yeah, okay, but my thing with Ambien is that I would take it, and I chain smoked back in those days.
Yeah.
And so I remember, like, I'd be on my couch, and I'd be chain smoking, and I'd go, okay, just try to fucking finish the cigarette before, because I would just pass out.
Yeah.
And I always made it, luckily.
That's really impressive.
But that's an insane game to play.
It is an insane, but, like, we all, I think, like, when we're on drugs, play weird games like that.
Yeah, we
do. I played a lot of weird games
like that. Yeah.
I remember the piece you wrote about the beep on your computer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, we all have weird things like that are, like, really, really deeply associated with, like, drug experiences.
Right. Yeah. That was traumatizing.
Yeah.
Do you remember those computers that when the Mac would ask you if you hadn't done anything in a minute, did you want to save? And do you remember how loud the beep was?
I don't remember it. But, like, you evoked the experience.
So that you feel like you experienced
it? Yes, I really do.
Okay, and so you were doing Ambien and you were doing...
Well, right. And then, you know, I was also taking Xanax, and then I was also, you know, like, using whatever street drugs I could get my hands on. Like, and you know, I was very much, like... you know, kind of classic polysubstance. Like,
right.
I didn't really care what it was. I just wanted to feel differently.
Drinking?
And I drank a lot, too. I mean, I drank a lot. And, you know, I went to high school in Manhattan and was around a lot of, like, kids who partied really hard.
Right.
And, you know, academically, the environment was fairly rigorous. And so that kind of explained the Adderall. And then I felt like I'd sort of earned whatever recreational...
Right.
abuse I was engaging in because I'd worked so hard.
Right.
And the competitive nature made it so, you know, I remember somebody saying to me that being in New York in high school, you know, in one of these, like, fairly elite environments.
Which one? Can we say which one you were at?
I was at a school called the Dwight School.
Right.
And being there, you know, there were three ways that you could spend your time. You could do well in school, you could have a social life, and you could sleep. And you got two out of three of those, but right. only two.
Right.
And you were never going to get all three at once. And
wow.
so I chose the school and
right.
the social life
right.
and just really didn't sleep at all, which
right.
meant a lot of Adderall.
Right.
And then and a lot of like Xanax and a lot of Ambien to try and like chill out because I wasn't sleeping. And taking like copious quantities of this narcolepsy medication called Provigil.
What?
That's been like prescribed off label for like increasingly for ADHD. They use it in the U.S. military as the new, like, go pill. It's replaced
okay.
amphetamine as what they give to soldiers on, like, long missions.
But more importantly, was it fun?
It was not fun. It was, like, objectively not fun at all. And this was the kind of drug addict that I was. Like, I really wanted to be, like, exceptional. Like, I wanted to be the best at
right,
everything.
Right, right.
And so, like, this drug, which produced no euphoria, like, did not get me high at all.
Right.
But I would take it, like, every 8 hours or so. And they've done studies, and you can take it for up to, like, 96 hours consecutively without sleep with no deterioration of your mental functioning. So it's like...
What about your body? What does that feel like?
Your body's fucked. Like, your body's...
Right, but
your body
if your
feels
mind
like
was
shit.
Okay, I wonder what that would be like.
But my body was fucked anyway because of
right.
all the other drugs.
But so it was also 20 or 21 years old, so it could
younger,
kind of rejuvenate.
Younger. Yeah, no, I was 17.
Right,
I didn't
right.
give a fuck, like,
right.
what kind of damage I was doing
right.
to my body. I just wanted to, like... I wanted to be able to, like... be a total rock star and, like, you know, be great in school and
right.
go to a great college and, you know, whatever, and also, like, have fun and get fucked up with my friends.
Right,
and so
right.
that's what I tried to do, and ultimately it didn't go so well for me. It was not sustainable.
And do you think that you were self-medicating, certainly ADD, or no? Or what do you think this was about? Or do you think you were just born an alcoholic and that's what was going on?
It's a really good question. I think I'm genetically predisposed to addiction. It runs in my family,
right.
certainly. I grew up hearing from my mother, who is not an alcoholic or an addict, but has it on both sides of her family, that, you know, if I experimented with drugs, if I, you know, drank, I was probably going to end up becoming an alcoholic or an addict. And like, to some extent, I sort of had this promise of, like, inevitable sobriety in my future.
Right,
And so that wasn't something that I was tracking necessarily. I felt like I had it under control for a long time. I knew, you know, in high school, I knew that I hated the way that I felt.
Right.
I knew that I didn't like the way I felt
right.
any of the time. I was uncomfortable all the time.
Did you know that that was not normal? I mean, didn't you just assume everybody felt like that?
I think I probably did, and I think I felt smarter because I had found all of these ways to make myself feel differently.
Right.
And, like, you know, I mean, the social climate that I was in was one where people partied pretty hard and, like,
right.
traded and took a lot of prescription drugs and, like, did a lot of coke and,
right.
and smoked a lot of weed and drank a lot. And yet, like, I was the only person out of my friends who was on something all the time. And I mean all the time. You know, I was never not on some kind of pill
right.
regimen. And it felt
right.
like... It always felt like, you know, I could figure out, like, the dosages and what to take and how to take it, like, how to ingest it. And I was always trying to get to that place where I could sort of transcend my humanity and become superhuman and just be this machine that could, like, go out and do whatever I wanted and be great in school and, like, get into an awesome college and like, do all of these things at once that felt sort of impossible because I felt like such a fuck-up on the inside. But
right.
I was always looking for a solution, and all of these pills and different drugs felt like the solution.
Well, and ironically, though it failed,
yeah.
your plan did work. You did go to a great college. You did
sort
do
of.
All of those things. Well,
sort
tell
of.
Us how.
Yeah. Well,
so I
end up, I get sent to treatment. I spend the summer in treatment. I go to Vassar. I, you know, none of the issues that have been brought up in treatment have been resolved. You know,
right.
I can't really make, it just sort of opened a bunch
of
wounds.
You went 30
wounds.
Days.
Yeah, well, no, I was 2 months in Wilderness and then, went to a residential rehab, in Kentucky, and got kicked out for sleeping with my roommate.
They didn't know you two were...
They put
that
the
way.
Only, they put the only two gay kids
together?
In a room
That's
together.
That's idiotic.
Like,
yeah.
What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
And so then I they transferred me to a program that was for like, you know, cross addictions in New Orleans, and I didn't last very long there. I just, you know, I felt like I was, like, locked up with a bunch of lunatics, which I basically was. You know, right. It was like a lockdown psychiatric unit.
Right.
And so I went back to New York, and I had this offer of admission from Vassar, so I decided to go to Vassar and give Vassar a try.
Right. And your parents, meanwhile, are freaking out, are not freaking out?
My parents were, I think my mother knew that my going to Vassar was a very bad idea.
Right.
She didn't think that was something that should happen. I think my father was not totally engaged with my decision-making process. And you know, it wasn't, I don't think anybody knew quite what to do.
Right.
Because on the one hand, you know, I was pretty bright and, and I was ambitious and I was motivated and I was also just like a total fucking mess. But, you know, like, I'd gotten into this school.
Right, right. And one hopes for the best.
Right, of course.
So.
And I think, like, you know, perhaps all of us were overly optimistic. And,
right.
And indeed, you know, I didn't last very long at Vassar. I was only there for a couple months. I couldn't finish out the term. The drugs got really out of control again. I went back to treatment.
Right.
And then, you know, after that, I was sober for about a year. Relapsed, went back to treatment, got sober again. And I've been continuously sober for the last five years and change.
And so how many treatment centers in all?
Seven.
Seven treatment centers. But I feel like, because I remember you wrote this XO Jane piece about a food treatment center.
Yes, yes. So
when was that?
So that was when I was 18, and I had been sober for about a year, sober from drugs and alcohol. And in that, these issues with food and this disordered eating stuff that had sort of been an ongoing problem, and I think a big part of my attraction to drugs of abuse like Adderall was that it curbed my appetite and I lost weight, and I liked the way I felt, and I liked not having to eat.
Right.
And so being off that in sobriety and not really knowing how to manage my relationship with food or my body without drugs, this eating disordered stuff kind of like reared its head.
Meaning you were like eating stuff your feelings or not eating at all?
It was sort of like a mix of both. Like
right.
I was never sort of cut and dry anything. It was just like, you know, I would restrict my food for like extended periods of time. I would binge eat. I would binge and purge. I would do all kinds of weird shit around food.
Right.
And sort of similar to the drugs, it was never like, you know, it's not like I was ever like a heroin addict or an anorexic. It was like, you know, I hated the way I felt. I hated everything about me. And I just wanted to change that. So, like, give me some drugs to fix that. I don't care what they are.
Right.
Give me something, you know, to eat or not eat or to do with my body that will change my body so I feel like I have some control and I can change the way I feel. That was sort of the pattern.
Right,
and that was the pattern with sex. That was the pattern with spending. That was the pattern with with everything.
Right.
It was like, it just always felt like there was something really wrong with me that I couldn't kind of get this under control. And it felt like sort of process addiction whack-a-mole, you know, like as soon as I would wrangle something and rein it in, something else would rear its head because there was something in me that just made me need to act out somehow.
But I'm curious, I mean, I totally relate to that, but like, I do feel like part of my experience of getting sober and getting really sober, I mean, I guess not counting the first few years, was actually what started to happen is once I started to understand what addiction was and what this desire to escape my feelings and this understanding that nothing was going to work, that the feelings were still going to be there, that it was only going to make them worse.
Yeah.
It started to get everything a little more under control. My food thing got the most under control when I quit smoking.
Really?
Ironically, which is when it's supposed to go the most out of control. I just sort of was like, oh, I get this. Like, because smoking was the second thing. It was kind of harder for me to do than getting sober almost.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. So I'm just looking for outs.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
I mean, did that happen or was it more because it was whack-a-mole, you had to kind of deal with one at a time?
I think for a long time it felt like whack-a-mole. And then I hit a point when I had maybe 2 years sober where it just didn't really feel that way anymore. It didn't feel like I constantly needed something to act out with. To be totally honest, I think one of the things that I inherited from my father was like a real workaholic streak.
And
I think a lot of people in sobriety find that they end up throwing themselves into their work because they feel purposeful and you know, when you're working all the time, you aren't really feeling your feelings.
But is that so bad? I would just like to challenge you with that.
No.
As a profound workaholic.
I remain a workaholic. Yeah. I think that work and feeling purposeful in my work is the thing that made my experience of it made the whack-a-mole game stop.
Right.
Yeah. I feel like once I felt like I was doing what I loved, once I started working as a writer,
right.
I felt like I could hold my head high. I felt purposeful. I felt like I had intention. And I didn't feel like I needed to change the way I felt all the time.
Right.
A lot of the time I still had the desire to. Absolutely.
And still do to me of course, today.
Yeah,
yes.
Still. But the urgency of it diminished or sort of waned in its intensity.
But the true recovery, I guess, comes from being like, oh, if I was just sitting on a porch and I didn't have this identity of Sam Lansky, this funny guy who is, and didn't need all that validation, like we would be truly healed human beings. But being a truly healed human being is probably kind of dull.
I've had a real struggle in sobriety with I feel a sort of tension between this idea that I want to be serene and like fine with who I am and in a place of acceptance and in a place of surrender, and I also have a hard time feeling that way and not feeling totally complacent. And mm-hmm. I feel like mm-hmm. in some ways, I don't know how to reconcile serenity with ambition. Like, I feel like being insecure or being not totally right with myself is the most powerful motivator that I have to do better, which then brings me a fulfillment that feels, whether it is or not, I can't say, that feels more sort of sophisticated or more ultimately gratifying than, like, nirvana, than like the bliss of just like being with yourself and being satisfied with yourself.
I mean, because that's the thing. I mean, workaholism is a real thing, but like what we know about these other quote unquote highs or escapist things is they don't work.
Right.
Workaholism works.
Workaholism does work. And like the gratification that I feel from having done a really good job is powerful and has more lasting, has more staying power than, a line of coke, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, it's something I definitely think about a lot. And you know, because I know for me, it's like mine has caused health problems. Like right now I'm like in a situation where like I'm super into my work and my neck and shoulders are so tight from being at my computer that I actually, could barely function for several hours over the weekend. And I'm like back on the, fucking like needle in the arm again Monday morning because I can't resist.
Yeah.
And I know that's not, ideal, but it's, for me, I was not like you. I was kind of more like, I wasn't even an interesting fuck up. I was a fuck up of a very low grade.
Yeah.
So it was like I was a B-minus student from a very smart, ambitious family.
Yeah.
And so no one said, oh, that's so sad. Look at that tragedy.
Right.
They just were like, oh, that girl's okay.
Right.
And that was always my big thing. So nobody thought I was smart. Nobody thought I would do much. And I have this really smart older brother who's always been very smart in a loud way.
Yeah.
And so it was a great, and I never was a hard worker at all. And so it was this great shock to me. And the minute I got sober, I was like, oh my God, I'm like Reese Witherspoon in Election with the number two pencil. Like I was the most motivated, ambitious person. And you would have had no idea the previous 29 years of my life.
But I think that's part of what happens when you get sober though, is that like it sort of unlocks the energy that you've been expending being an active addict or alcoholic, which is fucking exhausting. Like,
yeah.
That is hard work.
Yeah.
It's not easy. It's very, very tiresome.
Yeah.
All of that can get redirected towards other means. And I don't think it's quite this simple, but to some extent I feel like alcoholics and addicts are people who have an excess of certainly emotional energy, if not intellectual energy.
Sometimes,
and I feel and I feel like there's, when you're left with all of that, all of the sort of like leftover stuff, feeling stuff that you have been using to medicate it.
Right. Then, you need somewhere to go.
Right. And so for me, it definitely led me towards work. I think the same is true for you. And that has been a source of like real pride for me,
I think,
in sort of having a better understanding of myself and my direction and what I want
to
do.
But, and I mean, I'm talking as much to me as I am to you, like this knowing that true esteem, like the big discovery for me in recovery was like, oh my God, esteem does not come from getting attention from men. It does not come from getting that job. It comes from doing esteemable acts. Huge revelation to me.
Yeah.
And yet we live in a world that is increasingly about giving the validation, you know, the Twitter, you know, and the retweets and the favorites and the, all of that. And it's really hard because I know I'm dependent on it.
Yeah.
And I know too. It's not good for me.
I am too. I definitely know that I am. And it's dangerous in some ways in terms of feeling like I have to be sort of like attached to the teat of of this like stream of validation and affirmation.
But it's hard when you get it. I mean, with Twitter, the most dangerous part about it is that it does give that validation I always sought.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
On the regular.
It's so gratifying.
Yeah.
I love Twitter so much and I'm 100% addicted to Twitter and I've thought many times about like if I would be able to go back to rehab and not be on the internet for 30 days,
right.
I don't think I would be able to do it. Like,
right.
I've really thought
right,
about
right,
this.
Right,
because,
right.
you know, like, I don't know. You went to treatment,
yeah.
right?
No, I did actually outpatient, which is weird.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah,
we talked about this.
Yeah.
I loved being in inpatient treatment. Like,
right.
I loved it because the whole world just disappeared. And,
right.
And I felt like I was sort of... I mean, I think the reason that I went so many times is because when I figured out that, like, rehab was a place where someone or something
right.
would pay for me to talk about myself for 30 days,
right.
that was the fucking dream.
Right.
You know, like, I would
right.
gladly put up with whatever other bullshit they wanted to shove down my throat
right.
to have the luxury of, like, not having to work or go to school or, like, do anything.
And in one of those treatment centers give you a person to have sex with in your room.
Even better. Best of all. I mean, practically conjugal. I really, like, loved that about treatment. And even that, I think, would not... I mean, that's basically the same thing that Twitter is, though. Is, you know,
right.
like, talking about myself. Only I don't have
right.
to go away to do it.
And you don't have
like
to listen to anybody talk about themselves. Like, in group, you got to listen to that shit.
I have to... No, that's actually a really, really good revelation. That's the same thing that I loved about rehab is what I love about Twitter. Is
right,
that, like,
right, right.
I have a captive audience of people who are going to listen to me
and have
talk
to
about
respond.
Myself.
And some are always going to respond.
Absolutely. And that is, like, the greatest fucking thing in the world for
right.
someone like me.
Right.
I love that.
That
I
is brilliant. Will you write about that for
yes.
After Party Chat? That is
yes.
brilliant.
I totally will. I totally will.
Okay, but so what I would like to also further point out is that, okay, so you left, and this is what was interesting to me, because as an observer, watching you leave New York and go to, like, what sounded like crazy to me, like, what? Like,
yeah.
this guy's, like, you know, building this exciting career. Why would he do this? And it's like I sort of saw everything change for you over a year.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, it was like you had engineered the whole thing. You know, and suddenly you were writing for, you know, you wouldn't write for me anymore. And it was, you know, and
sorry,
I was,
Anna.
And by the way, I sort of hated everything about where I worked. So it was like, I was happier for you more than I was sad that
Thank you
wouldn't you. Write for me.
I appreciate that.
You know, but you were writing for New York Magazine and tell us more.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, I knew that, I felt sort of, like, trapped in, the rut that I was in, which felt like a fairly low-rent one. You know, I was doing sort of, like, shitty, tabloid entertainment bullshit.
It was better than that, though.
No, I mean, not the stuff for you.
No, but even the stuff, I knew the job you had back then.
It was, I mean, I certainly like to think, as we all do,
that
you
elevated it.
Yeah, that I made it better than what it objectively was. But ultimately, you know, the brand wasn't something that I was excited about,
right,
or that I wanted to be a part of. And I knew that there were other things that I wanted to work on and other projects that I wanted to tackle. And I wanted to, I wanted to like take some, MFA courses, and do some like, you know, other academic creative writing stuff.
Right.
My mom lives in Portland, so I went to Portland, and took some classes at, in the MFA program at Portland State, not like as an enrolled student, but just kind of like dabbling.
Right.
And those were really good. And I felt good about the work that I did there. And MTV had offered me a sort of contract gig doing a weekly column for them, and I started doing that. I started pitching. I started, you know, kind of taking on bigger things.
Right.
So I did some stuff for New York Magazine, The Atlantic, Billboard.
Grantland, didn't you do Grantland?
Grantland.
Yeah.
Yeah, Grantland, which I love, love, love so much. I did a long kind of feature for them.
And then didn't you do the Heidi Fleiss and her birds?
Yeah, so that has yet to run.
Okay.
So I can't
talk about
really
it.
Talk about
okay,
that.
I apologize. But I suddenly was like, was that even Sam? Suddenly
yeah,
it didn't seem like it was you.
No,
but yeah.
Yes, that was me. So there is a piece forthcoming
yes.
at some to-be-determined point
right.
in the future
right,
about Heidi Fleiss and her birds.
And that's going to be amazing, wherever that
I'm
runs
really,
and whenever that
I'm
runs.
Really, really excited about that piece. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it was just, like, even, like, sort of your Twitter totally changed. I noticed a dramatic change
yeah.
between, you know, the Sam pre-Portland and the Sam after. It was just suddenly you were sort of on fire and kind of,
I
felt like that.
I feel like I sort of, like, I began to understand Twitter,
your voice
like how Twitter
and your
worked.
Voice, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, I think I sort of came into my own in terms of, like, the voice that I wanted to use when I wrote and how I was able to translate that over into Twitter.
Right.
And sort of felt like I suddenly kind of got a handle on who I wanted to be in a sort of writerly context.
Right.
And began to really understand, like, how in sort of like a 360 degree view that I needed to manage that, you know, in the work that I was doing and in the portfolio of clips that I was generating. And then in how that carried over into my social media presence. And
so funny. To me, I thought it was way more organic than that. That
oh,
like,
really?
You, oh, yeah. That it wasn't this, like, predetermined. Like, that you were just coming into your own and you were like, oh, this is who I am. Not that it was like, I must think about my social media presence. And
no, I would love to say that it was a really organic process. And there are pieces of it that were, certainly. But it felt like it was fairly calculated.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, I
well played, young man.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
It worked.
I realized, I mean, I guess the way in which it was calculated primarily is that I sort of saw through, like, trial and error, like,
yeah.
what people
responded to
and
right.
what people did not respond to.
Right.
And it became really clear what, you know, what I should do if I wanted to, if I wanted to sort of have the kind of career that I wanted to have and do the work that I wanted to do. And I guess I would also say, like, one of the things that's been gratifying for me, especially recently, just, like, over the last 6 months, is after doing a lot of personal writing, primarily for you on The Fix.
Mm-hmm.
And then
your blog.
And then, and then I did some personal writing on my blog, and then I basically abandoned that writing personal stuff publicly for about a year, or maybe a little bit more.
Interesting.
And focused primarily on entertainment and culture
right,
writing.
Right.
And built up more of a following on Twitter for, you know, having commentary on celebrities
yeah.
and music, especially since I ended up then getting a full-time job writing about music all the time. And sort of the following that I built, which is, you know, which is not, like, a huge following
well,
by any stretch of the imagination.
I noticed just from when you retweeted one of the stories that you did for me,
mm-hmm.
that they're very dedicated. So it's not about numbers. It's about how
that's,
responsive
that's
they are.
That's absolutely true. I am so, so, so fortunate that, you know, out of the little pocket of followers that I have, they're very, very, they are invested in
yeah.
like, the work that I'm doing
yeah.
In a way that feels more than casual. And I absolutely love that. I mean, like, it means so, so, so much to me.
But this thing, I mean, because the thing about you, I mean, your passion is music, and one could say not even great music, like
absolutely.
Pop music is, and so
absolutely.
What's so interesting and special, I think, about the work that you do is, like, is that we have this very brilliant mind focusing on what could be called, like, throwaway pop music, and that's not something that happens a lot.
It's very kind of you to call me brilliant. I always said that I wanted to write deeply about the shallowest things.
Right,
and,
right. That's such a noble goal.
Thank you so much.
But yes.
I do feel like, and you know, I write about other entertainment stuff, and I, you know, I like to think that I cover, you know, more ground than just music, but pop music is really my mainstay. And my feeling is that, you know, the smart people who want to be writers and editors generally have better taste than that.
Right.
They, you know, if they want to write about music, they want to write for Spin or Pitchfork or
right.
Rolling Stone. and they want to write about, like, serious, kind of credible music.
Right.
Although more people every day are engaging with, you know, Miley Cyrus than the Black Keys.
Right.
You know, just in terms of, like, the kind of cultural output and,
right.
and how we, you know, as a culture are being affected or shaped or our experiences are being informed by the cultural impact that Miley Cyrus has.
Right.
So if we're not talking about Miley Cyrus because all of the smart people are over here talking about the Black Keys,
right.
then there's a real sort of blind spot in terms
right.
Of doing a thoughtful or at least deliberate exploration of, like, what this means with a capital M.
Right.
And not everything I write is about, like, the capital M meaning of Miley Cyrus.
Right.
But I'm very fortunate to be in a position where both in my freelance work and then also in my full-time real job as an editor at Idolator, which is Spin Media's pop music website,
right.
I get to do sort of more detailed, in-depth,
right. Right.
And kind of critical looks at the mainstream pop music that is widely regarded as disposable or not credible.
Right, right. It's interesting because my third book was the reality,
yeah.
a collection of reality essays about reality
right.
TV, and I figured, and I, it was sort of the same concept. It was like, well, if I get smart people writing about dumb things, then I'm going to get the whole audience. I'm going to get smart people and dumb people, and
right.
I know it's not that simplistic at all.
No,
but
that
I was wrong
really?
Because, as it turned out, smart people don't want to read about yes. The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills always.
Which is so stupid.
Which
because
is
that's
their
all
loss.
I want to read about.
I know.
All I want to read about.
And
did I ever send you my essay about The Real Housewives?
I don't know. But is it about the Beverly Hills
yes.
Housewives? Yeah, I mean, I'm, yeah, my obsession with that is
I'm
not
I'm
going
to send it to you.
Yeah,
I wrote it, like,
please.
2 years ago and, like, almost got it into Harper's, like, was so close, and that was, like, a fucking dream come
right,
true.
Right, right.
And, like, it just kind of fell apart. But I'll send it to you.
I want, yeah. I mean, there's so much to say, and I would go on and read Julie Klausner's blogs and
incredible.
And read those comments for
yeah.
hours
yeah.
the next day.
Oh, no, those were absolutely extraordinary. Her, I wrote about that in my piece, which I don't know why I'm talking about because it's
I
not published.
I feel like
in
I read this. Could you have shown this? It just sounds familiar. And you writing about Julie's column, that sounds familiar, but go on.
It's possible. It's
okay.
possible.
Go on.
I love that show so much. Her recaps and Richard Lawson's recaps were, like, you know,
I
just
know. It's kind of tragic
gold.
That he doesn't do them anymore, really.
I know, yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame.
But yeah, I mean, because to me, and I feel like this about the real world too.
Yeah.
I am an adult. I am a more than middle-aged woman,
yeah.
and I learn things about human behavior
absolutely.
That are profound
mm-hmm.
from The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and from the real world, which is a
yes.
far less popular position to take.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, the real world feels like going to a meeting
yeah.
to me. It's
yeah.
like a reminder why I don't drink anymore, what can happen.
Totally.
And The Real Housewives is sort of why I have emotional sobriety. Because
yeah. right.
I want to behave. I understand every single one of their instincts.
Yes.
I have the same insecurities, but
yeah.
I have learned not to do that.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've actually thought. It's so funny that we're talking about this. I've thought about The Real Housewives a lot lately. I think about them a lot in general.
Right.
But I'm, like, in the first, like, kind of serious adult relationship of
right.
my serious adult
right,
life.
Right, right.
And I mean, like, I've been in relationships before, obviously, but this is the first one that feels sort of, like, real.
Well, yeah, and also, not to pry, but weren't they sort of with a lot of older men?
They were
that was, like, your thing?
Exclusively with older men.
Yes.
So this is the first time in my life I've ever dated an age peer.
Right.
And so I've thought in sort of, like, conflict as it's emerged in the relationship.
You compare it to what's
think,
happened?
No, I think about, I've never, because I always dated older men, there was always, there were always weird, fucked up power
yeah.
dynamics and differentials, and so conflict never felt, we were never sort of on the same, we were never on the same footing or on the same playing field.
Right.
So I never had conflict like this, you know, not that like, my boyfriend and I fight all the time by any
right,
stretch of the imagination.
Course.
But like,
right.
when, you know, when you're in a relationship and you have conversations about intense emotional stuff, I've understood the impulses of the Real Housewives for the first time in my life, and it's totally foreign,
like,
and
which ones?
Totally unfamiliar. I mean, like, I sort of have, like, a bit about, like, my desire to, like, throw wine at people, you know?
That's a Ramona?
Well, it's actually a Tamra Barney.
See, I'm only
Orange
Beverly
County
Hills
season
now.
Season 6 finale. Okay, season 5 finale, maybe. She throws a glass of red wine in Gina Keough's face, and it's, like, so fucking spectacular. I have an animated GIF of it.
Right.
As, like, a primary mode of communication. I do this a lot on Twitter too. Like, I think like the culture of like quote unquote drama and like quote unquote toxic people and a need to like clear the air and talking in this very like self-important, absurd, bullshit, new age way about like negativity and you know, like that sort of that rhetoric of like self-help bullshit that's been sort of adopted by reality TV gremlins in this like totally horrifying and objectionable way.
Right.
Like, I sort of make fun of that because I just think it's like hysterical the way these women all like sit around, you know, as they swill their Pinot, like talking about like, you know, toxic people and which of their friends they hate as they resolve to like remove negativity from their lives and, you know,
with
say,
the cameras going
and say it is what it is, you know, with this like, you know, false sageness. It's just like I think it's so stupid and so funny, and like I have found myself having thoughts of like, I'm just really sick of all this drama. Like, I just really want all this drama to go away.
Right.
Or like, oh, this feels totally toxic. I don't want to be a part of this. And I'm like, oh no, like, I'm becoming that. I'm totally becoming a participant in that culture that I think is so gross and weird.
I know. I get that.
It's really, really troubling.
But really, yeah, what they're doing is they're taking the, like, the cheat sheet version of like people who really go to therapy and really go to 12-step or whatever it is,
and actually resolve to like rid their lives of whatever ails them.
So because it's art imitating life, and then your life is like, what am I relating to that art that I you know, sort of derive?
Yeah, totally. And it's all just kind of circular,
but just just wait till Beverly Hills is back on the air is all I can say.
I'm so excited. I saw Jen very briefly. So I should give her a little shout out.
We should. Well, and she and I emailed, and she sent me the cutest email this morning. Yeah. And so, so we share a mutual friend.
Yes. Jen Jimenez.
Jen Jimenez.
Who is, was on Celebrity Rehab and Sober House.
Yes.
And is increasingly a fixture on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Yes.
Due to her friendship with Brandy Glanville.
Right.
Who's my personal favorite housewife.
Right. Who, you know, I met with to do her book, but it didn't work out.
That's right. You told me that.
Yes. It didn't work out. Yeah.
It's really a shame.
Yeah. But yes. And you became friends with Jen. How?
Through my friend Beth, who works in entertainment journalism, and who's known Jen for a really long time, and thought that we would get along and connected us up.
And she was
And I was such a Housewives enthusiast. And,
yes.
And so, Jen and I became friends that way, and now she's a dear friend.
And so you saw her. So you're in LA for just a few days.
Yes. Very brief day.
Okay. And Jen just started a website, too.
Yes. Jen started a website called Sober Book.
Yeah.
That's also a magazine in
Florida.
Yeah,
I need to find out more.
Yeah, I had very little sense of what the project was, but she's super excited about it and super motivated and really, I think, is doing great things with it, so I'm just
And
very,
she's
very
such
proud
a sweet
her.
Girl. She
oh,
really
she's
is.
The loveliest. She's just, like, the loveliest soul.
Right.
I love her pieces.
And so, okay, and so my, So my thing with you, it's just that, like, I'm excited to see what happens with you. Because I really...
Me too.
Because I do see you as someone who, you know, you're still so young. How old are you?
24.
And, like... Yeah, anything could happen. You know, it's funny because one of the writers that you referred to me, because you referred me several good writers at the old website.
Yes, I tried to.
And one was like, God, I mean, is he going to be like an Andy Cohen? Like, really, what's going to happen with Sam? He could do anything. But I think you're too good for that. I mean, I think you're better than an Andy Cohen. I know.
Wait, did somebody say that?
Yes.
Who said that?
McCartan.
McCartan said that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Yeah.
That's so sweet. I love that.
Yeah, but it's true. It's like, well, what will you do, you know?
Well, I think, I mean, like, for me, it definitely remains to be seen. I have a lot of stuff that I'm working on kind of all the time.
Yeah.
What I'm right now most excited about is I'm a couple weeks away right after Labor Day, my first book proposal will go out.
Great.
And I'm really looking forward to that and seeing how that plays
it
out.
It is a novel?
It is a memoir.
Nice.
It's a memoir about my wayward New York City youth.
This is great. I love it.
And it's called, the current title is How Not to Get into Princeton.
Well, I like it.
Because I really wanted to go to Princeton, and I literally did everything wrong.
Right.
I could not have fucked it up more.
Right.
From all of the Adderall to the having an affair with a powerful older man in the Princeton community who promised to pull strings for me to get me in.
I thought that would work.
It didn't work. It totally did not work.
Right.
I totally dropped the ball.
And just
failed miserably and did not get into Princeton. Spoiler alert.
Right.
But it's a project that I've worked really hard on, and I'm really, really excited to see where it leads, and definitely have high hopes for that.
I'm excited about that.
So that's sort of where I've been focusing a lot of my extra energy, in addition to the work I do at Idolater and elsewhere.
Okay. Well, while we are, this is so casual. I'm going to check Twitter to see if we have an addiction question.
Totally. I love that.
If we do not have an addiction question, we get to answer whatever. We got several.
Shit.
One is from my personal favorite person on Earth, next to you. Can the tape recorder still hear me?
I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
Lara Naiman.
Yes.
I am addicted to Sam Lansky. Oh, also, are any nightly sleeping pills advisable for a sober person? Asking for a friend. And then somebody else, at TitanBM, asked, what is the best piece of advice you could offer to someone struggling with recovery? Now.
These are good.
Yes.
These are good.
So, Sam, I have thoughts on the sleeping pill question.
Yes.
But these are questions are really first for you.
Okay.
So
with regard to being addicted to Sam Lansky, I'm afraid I don't have anything to...
Except keep doing what you're doing, Lara Naiman.
Yes. Enjoy it. Enjoy the high. Ride it out.
Lara Naiman and I once got to have dinner with you in New York.
That was an absolute treasure.
Do you understand what that did for the two of us?
What did it do for you?
I don't understand.
We were really
excited, and then we begged you to come to a party with us.
I know, I'm sorry.
And you did it.
So
no,
sorry.
And it was a terrible party, so it was like, it only added to our obsession because...
Yeah.
It was like, oh, he knew this was going to be a terrible party. He knew better than to come.
I remember that you guys really wanted me to come, and I laid out a fairly detailed explanation.
You had a good reason.
Of why I would not come.
You had a great reason.
From a logistical standpoint.
No, you had, it was like a PowerPoint presentation,
practically. Yeah, I knew. And I remember being, very pleased and satisfied with myself that you were actually convinced, that...
It worked. There was no way we couldn't have been with what you brought to the table.
I love that. I was very, very pleased with that. It felt like a minor coup.
It was, because I don't think Lara Naiman and I are easy to convince of anything.
No, not at all.
Together or separate.
No, not at all.
But yeah, I do remember, but sort of, the party was terrible, but like a sort of Heisenberg principle, it was terrible. I'm sure I'm using this incorrectly. If you would come, it wouldn't have been terrible.
That's probably the case.
Right.
Yes.
But we were sort of obsessed with you, and we were kind of tweeting at you from the, who knows. Anyway.
I think I remember that.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah. It was a good night.
Yeah.
So, sleeping pills, advice for a sober person.
Okay, so this is good for me to talk about. I occasionally take Tylenol PM when I need to knock myself out. There's a brand of energy drinks called Neuro, and they have a sleep drink which I have.
Really?
Yes, it comes in an orange bottle, and you can get it at 7-Eleven and some grocery stores. And it has it doesn't have anything particularly potent. It has magnesium and tryptophan.
Which is
Thanksgiving turkey.
You can take tryptophan pills too.
Yes,
that never
yes.
worked for me.
I've never actually tried it.
I did.
But this is whatever their blend of random vitamins and bullshit suspended in a gross sugar water.
Right.
And that knocks me out.
Okay,
it really, really works. Doesn't get me high, doesn't put me into any kind of impaired state.
Right.
I just get sort of sluggish.
Right.
And 30 to 40 minutes after drinking it, I'm out and I sleep really well.
Which is,
so I drink that sometimes.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. I recommend it.
And there's also a medication called Trazodone.
I'm familiar with Trazodone.
And we had a conversation about Trazodone because it turned out Kim Richards took it. Do you remember this conversation?
Yes, I do remember that. Yes. And it was of course Kim Richards takes Trazodone.
But you were super impressed. It was the one time I managed to impress you because I take Trazodone and you're like, that knocked me out for days.
Yeah, it did. That shit made me comatose. Totally.
Not
comatose.
Me. Barely puts a dent in my energy level.
Really?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
It's non-addictive. It is a failed antidepressant. It did not make people happier.
It's like an old school tricyclic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't make them happier. It just made them tired if they were anxious.
Yeah.
So that is one that is totally, you cannot get addicted to it. I mean, you do not build up a tolerance to it.
Right.
I am not an MD. I should probably make that clear.
Yeah.
But
I'm really not either.
You're not?
Not even close.
I mean, I'm praising you so much that it almost feels like
really
I should call
wonderful.
You a doctor. It's all true.
I love that.
What was the other question was, best piece of sober advice?
Aside over here. It was, what is the best piece of advice you could offer to someone struggling with recovery?
God. That's a really good question. Let me think about this for a minute. I have found myself, like, for the first time in my sober life, definitely the last 5 years that I've been sober, I find that different, like, cliches and platitudes and things that I hear circulated, like, sort of kind of go, they don't go in one ear and out the other, they, like, go in and they sort of, like, take place somewhere in my brain, and then occasionally they rise up when they feel relevant,
right.
But generally they don't feel relevant when I hear them. When I hear them, they feel like bullshit.
Right.
And, I have, like, been so into this too shall pass lately. And like it is assumed this like level of profundity that it had never
right
had
that four
before.
Words almost shouldn't have
yeah
this too
right
shall pass.
Yes
thank you
exactly. I think like that's it doesn't always help in the moment to know that whatever you're feeling is ultimately transient and
right.
like will not be around forever
right.
But I am frequently. I frequently need to be reminded that feelings change. You know, like your feelings change.
Yeah.
And whatever, no matter how kind of gripping or debilitating something feels in the immediate moment,
right.
It won't feel that way forever. And I think that is something that I've held on to throughout sobriety, even if I didn't really connect it to this too shall pass.
Right.
I always knew that like no matter how ugly and awful it wasn't going to be that way forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think is one of the greatest things I've learned in sobriety, because the truth was, they didn't pass. The feelings, the ironic thing about the addict, you know, because I think addiction is just, I can't handle this feeling, I'll do anything I can to change it.
Right, totally.
And so you put toxic chemicals into your system, and the irony is that it makes those bad feelings actually last.
Yeah.
Whether it, you know, some
That's
drugs
true.
Eradicate them in the moment and
That's
they come
true.
Back, but whatever it is, it emphasizes it. So
yeah.
I would get depressed, and I could stay depressed for 2 years,
yeah.
3 years, and in sobriety to go, and it's not that I haven't had lengthy depressions in sobriety, but, like, I've also had ones that last an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, but
and then it's over.
Yeah.
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 And, but, you know, I also think that struggling, if you're struggling, you know, there can be all kinds, there can be, you know, what you said, sort of just like hang tight, it's going to pass.
Yeah.
The pain comes from, in my experience, clinging and not like surrendering, just sort of going, this is it.
Right.
This is fucking it. But also sometimes, you know, outside help, medication, antidepressants, things like that can really help.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but you know, I think talking about it and until you get an answer about what it is.
Yeah, is definitely useful.
And drinking and doing drugs is never going to make it any better. It
doesn't really work.
It doesn't work at all.
Yeah. I mean, it works until it stops working. And then when it stops working, it's so horrible.
Yeah, I mean, my thing, my one relapse, you know, I ended up, you know, like, 2 bottles of wine and 4.5 hits of ecstasy the night I decided to drink.
Yeah.
It didn't work for me real fast.
No, yeah.
Real fast.
I understand. My one relapse was, like, really, really ugly. And really
yeah.
Dark. Yeah.
Well, okay, so thank you for your questions. Please keep sending them. I hope we answered them. I know we really successfully answered I Am Addicted to Sam Lansky.
Yes, which is the most crucial question.
It's not a question, but it's a great question at the same time.
It's an issue. It's an issue.
Okay, and so now there's a little quiz. And I've changed this up a little bit. I think I'm going to make this purely a My Strange Addiction quiz for this podcast and future podcasts.
Okay.
I'm going to give you three scenarios, and you have to tell me which was not an episode of My Strange Addiction.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't watch My Strange Addiction.
That me neither. Matter.
Okay.
Doesn't matter. Okay. Perfect. The woman who drinks shampoo, the woman who sniffs baby powder, and the woman who drinks her own urine.
Baby powder.
Okay, but just to make this game more fun, tell me why. I'm not telling you if you're right or wrong, but you're wrong, but tell me anyway.
Shit. What was the first one? What was the first option?
Drinks shampoo. That was the fake story.
Okay, so
because that sounded like the most likely.
It did. So I ruled that out because it sounded like the most likely, and the woman who drinks her own urine also sounded really likely because that felt like something that was sort of like textbook taboo or transgressive in a way that would like appeal to somebody with like a not particularly exciting relationship with their own, like, need to be weird and gross, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, it gets even weirder. I read this online because, of course, I haven't seen this show.
Yeah.
That it was because she thought it would cure her of cancer, which makes it all sad. I'm so sorry. But
that's like
anyway,
ultra dark.
I know. Yeah. But you saw baby powder. She went with baby powder.
Yeah.
That was true. That was
really?
A true thing, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't love that for her.
No. None of these are, you're going to love. Okay, but here's another one. So that was wrong, and
okay.
I apologize
I
to you for failing so badly.
I failed.
Okay, which is not an episode of My Strange Addiction. The woman who eats cat food. I got to remember which one I made up. The woman who pees in her cat's litter box, and the woman who licks and eats her cat's hair.
Shit.
I know. This is not an easy quiz.
It's a really tough quiz. A really tough quiz. I'm going to go with the woman who licks and eats her cat's hair.
I'm so sorry, but you got that one wrong, too.
God,
that's
so
a real
I'm
thing.
So
that's why this game
this.
Is... I can't really
so
decide if this,
this
game is fun, because nobody can do it.
Yeah,
so it's
it
fun
might,
for
it
me.
It might be too hard. It might be too hard.
It might be. It
yeah.
might be. Do you want to know the fake one?
Yeah.
The woman who pees in her cat's litter box. Come on.
That to me felt like the most outrageous, which made me think that it had to be true because it was
right, that's the tricky part. That's
yeah.
the tricky part.
Yeah, very tricky.
Yeah. Well, although you failed at the game, you have succeeded in life.
Thank you so much.
And
I feel that way.
And so where can people find you?
So, they can find me on Twitter,
mm-hmm.
At Sam Lansky,
L-A-N-S-K-Y.
Right. Let's spell it out.
Yeah, it's important.
I have a personal blog where I post pieces of personal writing and just, like, random pop culture detritus.
Shut Ever, right?
Which is called Shut Ever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Shut Up Plus Whatever.
Right, love it.
Which is shutever.com. And then I have a sort of ongoing portfolio of work at samlansky.com.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the best places to seek me out.
Well, this was such a pleasure.
It really was.
Right? It was more fun than you expected.
It was very
And
very
you expected fun.
I expected a lot of fun.
Right.
And I was not disappointed.
Okay. I'm so glad. And, thank you.
Thank you.